Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. China, by all accounts, has and continues to experience a dramatic national transformation. Population, which has dramatically changed from a rural agrarian society to an increasingly urbanized one. The country has simultaneously experienced both an industrial and technological revolution and emerged from an economic backwater to economic powerhouse in the course of a single lifespan. While Americans have cast an increasingly wary eye towards China's economy and the power that accompanies it, such transformation exposes serious fault lines within the society. My guest today writes of one major area, the social, cultural, and economic chasm between urban and rural citizens within China. For rural migrants to the city, their plight is similar to immigrants coming to America, though they're living in their own country. They fill the lowest-paying jobs, very little job protections, no safety net, and are entrenched in a system that more often resembles a caste system within China. These rural migrants refer to Chirku, Eating Bitterness, and that is the name of the book by my guest today, Michelle Damon Loyalka. Eating Bitterness, Stories from the Front Lines of China's Great Urban Migration. It's published by the University of California Press. Loyalka is a freelance journalist and editor who's lived in China for the past 13 years, and she joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Michelle Damon Loyalka, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
In 2007 or 2008, depends on who you talk to, the world's population for the first time became more urban than rural. In fact, you've written about probably one of the great contributors to this change, the urbanization of China.
That's right.
And the sheer numbers are staggering to those who haven't witnessed it firsthand. How profound has this change been of urbanization in China?
It's an amazing transformation. I mean, if you look in terms of Western countries making a shift from rural to urban countries, it happened approximately about 200 years. But in China, it's happening in the course of about 50 years. So in the next 20 years, there's going to be 1 billion people in Chinese cities. The numbers are amazing. 221 cities will have at least 1 million people. And to make this happen, it's basically happening through rural migration. And already there's 200 million people every year who come to the cities from the countryside looking for more jobs.
And what you describe, it's very much like a migrant population, much like we see in the United States, in our case, immigrants. But within China, it's almost like an immigration population within the country of rural versus urban.
Yeah, absolutely. In China, they have a system which is called the household registration system or the hukou system. And essentially what that is a way that in the past they controlled movement of the population. So China has had some version of this for the last 2,000 years. And the latest sort of reincarnation came from Mao in the late 50s as a way to keep the farmers from fleeing the countryside after collectivization began. And so today it isn't really used to control movement so much, but it's still used as a way of allocating benefits. So in China, everybody is entitled to, you know, health care and free schooling and things like that, but only in the place where they have their registration. And so for rural migrants, when they come to the cities, they aren't registered in the cities, and so they are oftentimes denied access to affordable health care. Their kids are oftentimes denied entrance into city schools. And so it really does create this sort of two-class system within the same country. And it's a really serious and growing problem that China is having to tackle.
Is this urbanization happening despite the government, or is the government actually encouraging it?
Well, it's interesting. So in the beginning, like in the 50s, again, they were trying to stop it from happening. And then in the early 80s, they essentially loosened the restrictions and started to allow migration to happen as the reforms began in China. Today, they need more migrants to come because, again, this amazingly rapid urbanization that's happening, it really needs a huge influx of labor to make it happen. I mean, we often think, I think in the West, we have this image of a lot of China's migrants working in factories. But in fact, of the 200 and some million migrants that are out at any time, only about a third of them are actually factory workers. The rest are sort of intimately connected with every aspect of China's own domestic life, and they're very essential to this city-building process that's happening. I think there's something like 50,000 new skyscrapers will be built in the next 20 years, and 5 billion square meters of roads will be paved. And all of this will happen mostly by rural migrants. So the government is definitely at this point not discouraging migration by any means.
But what you describe in the book, it's almost like the rural migrants take the role of what would be immigrants in this country. They're
maybe
not the cab drivers, but they're working the low-paid labor jobs. They're doing, it's a lot of times manual labor. They're doing maid work, counter sales, anything that they're qualified for. And, of course, this also sort of shows you that there's this big divide between everything from the status to the educational opportunities, the health care between urban and rural. This is what could be a really potent cultural divide for the country for years to come.
Yeah, absolutely. In China, the interesting thing is because of this household registration system that they have, rural and urban aren't just adjectives. They're actually legal definitions. And so if you are born with a rural registration, and the way you become categorized as rural or urban doesn't depend on where you're born. It depends on the registration of your parents. So if your parents are registered as rural residents, then you're going to be registered as a rural resident.
It sounds like a caste system.
Well, kind of. And the only way that you can really change this, I mean, the easiest way to change it, at least, is to go to college. So if you can test into college in China, then you usually have the opportunity to change your registration into a city registration, and you essentially become a white-collar worker and sort of integrate, you know, seamlessly into the urban society. But if you don't go to college, it's really hard to change that registration. And so a lot of the migrants that I talk to, they would say, you know, in China, if you're born a farmer, you're always a farmer. And they had this mentality that, you know, they may come out to the city temporarily for work, but again, as you just pointed out, oftentimes it's very low-skilled labor, and a lot of times it's very manual labor. And so they would often say, you know, when my body wears out and there's nothing else I can contribute to the city, I know that I'll go back to the countryside, continue to farm my land. And that was kind of their life outlook, that they're once a farmer, always a farmer, and there's really not a way to change that in time.
And for those rural migrants, that portion of land which happened after collectivization, that's their entire safety net, isn't it?
That really is. I mean, it's hard to underestimate, especially China, you know, had widespread starvation just a few decades ago. So for these migrants, that land, well, not just these migrants, for people in the countryside, that land is seen as a huge safety net. And it's interesting because on the one hand, it's a safety net, but on the other hand, it's also sort of what's pushing people to the cities. Because when China ended collectivized agriculture in the late 70s and early 80s, what they did with that land was they essentially, every village took its communal land and redistributed it to all of its rural residents. And the problem is in China, by the time you divvy up all this land among 700 million rural residents, every person only gets about a sixth of an acre. So even if you assume a family of four, you're talking about a piece of land that's about 600 times smaller than an average American family farm.
Right. It's basically a personal plot. It's enough to keep you from starving, not enough to make a living.
Exactly. Exactly. It's enough to, it's your safety net again. But if any family who wants to do more than just sort of keep themselves fed, usually what they have to do is send at least one family member out to the cities to look for work. And in a lot of families in the countryside, both parents will be out looking for work, and the children will stay back in the village with grandparents or other relatives.
Well, the name of the book, Eating Bitterness, comes from this phrase, a Chinese phrase. I believe it's chiku, is that right?
Chirku.
Chirku.
Chirku, right.
Chirku, which means eating bitterness, and it really describes a mindset among these rural migrants.
That's right. In Chinese, this word chirku, I think it's such a great word because it kind of sums up a lot of qualities all in one. So there's this ability to endure difficulties, to sort of persevere through hardships and to continue to press ahead all in one without really stopping to, you know, complain or think about, is this fair or not? Is this what I want to do or not? And so, yeah, in English, there's not one word that can kind of capture all this. So it just translated directly into eating bitterness. And it's really been a long-held value in Chinese culture, but I think especially, you know, the last century in China has been very tumultuous, and people had to hone this ability to a whole new level, especially people from the countryside who faced collectivization and starvation and a lot of difficulties. So I didn't start off, when I went to write the book, I didn't even start off with this as a theme necessarily. It wasn't in my mind, but when I talked with the migrants, over and over, they themselves would bring up this ability as sort of the key to their being able to stay in the city and survive in the city despite all these difficulties they faced.
I assume it's a slang term, just meaning for, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah, kind of like suck it up or something like that, exactly. Yeah. And I really think that in the end, it's been a key to China's ability to move ahead so quickly. They have this labor force that they can rely on that's not only been, you know, plentiful and cheap, but also very sort of resolute and non-complaining and just sort of bearing down and pushing ahead.
In the book, you document the practical effects of what's been called the Great Opening of the West. And this was launched in China around 2000. It's basically, you have Eastern China, Shanghai, Beijing, you know, now Hong Kong and the Southern China, all these great cities where there's quite a bit of concentration of wealth, where I think if a Western visitor came to these places, you could see the old China, but you see this huge new China. Well, right. Western China has not shared equally in that.
That's right. Actually, when China started its reforms about 30 years ago, it had this idea that it would first let a small portion of the population become wealthy, and that group of people would then essentially sort of pull up the rest of China. And so they chose Eastern China, and especially that little crescent of cities along the coast there, to sort of lead China to prosperity. And Western China was really sort of just, you know, neglected, left alone. And so for 20 years, Eastern China essentially developed very quickly and became sort of, like you said, this sort of flashy new face of China, and Western China just sort of languished behind. And in 2000, I think the government realized, you know, the gap between Western and Eastern China was too great, and they started this policy called the Great Opening of the West policy, which essentially was aimed at helping the West to sort of, you know, develop quickly and come up to speed with the rest of the country. And I think that, you know, at the same time, what happened in recent years, at least, is that Eastern China now has developed to the degree that the standard of living is so high and now the cost of living is so high that it's not such a great place anymore for, say, factories and businesses. And a lot of migrants aren't as willing as before to go to Eastern China because it's so expensive to live there now. And so we're starting to see sort of the reverse trend taking place where now people are moving their factories and companies back to Western China. And so I think, you know, Western China actually is the ancient capital of China and the cradle of Chinese civilization. And so it's the ancient face of China, but I think it's also the new face of China. And we're going to hear a lot more about it in the coming years.
And you documented, I believe it's Qian, is that right?
Qian, right.
Qian, yeah.
Which
Qian
means Western peace.
Yeah. And this is one of the old capitals of China.
That's right.
It's where the terracotta warriors are.
Mm-hmm.
And you describe two distinct places within Qian. One is the high-tech zone, which is, you know, your typical Western high-rises and building boom. And right next to it, a village? Is that safe to say?
Absolutely.
Ganjijai?
Ganjijai, that's right. So it's interesting the way that urbanization has happened in China is that as the city starts to spread, the local government will buy up the land, village land, but they don't generally buy up the village houses because most villages in China, the houses are all clustered together sort of in the center of the land. And so that's what happened here is the high-tech zone was built on the land of this village, but the village houses remained. And so what the villagers did is they took the money they got as a payout for their land and they built onto their homes. They built, you know, it used to be one-story homes, now they're four-story homes, and essentially did that so they could become landlords. So as the high-tech zone developed, this flood of rural migrants came pouring into the area looking for opportunities, and not able to afford, you know, life in this high-tech zone, the migrants would rent out rooms in this old village. And so that old village, when I was living in Qian, I was living in the high-tech zone, and from my apartment, I could see this was right after the Great Opening of the West policy started, and I could see, you know, at any given time there would be 10 to 20 cranes on the horizon building up new high-rises. But then there was also this old village of Ganjijai, which used to hold about 1,500 farmers, and now it was packed with about 30,000 rural migrants who had all rushed into the area.
Wow.
Yeah, and this is about a five-block area. And this is very common in China, I should say. It's even got a term. It's called city villages. So these old villages remain in the middle of very urbanized areas. And the original farmers who lost their land in the process, they become landlords. Oftentimes building, you know, if the government doesn't control how high they build up, they often build up their homes, you know, 8, 9 stories in very densely populated areas. And this is the way that China has sort of avoided that urban slums with absolute poverty like you might see in India or Brazil.
My guest today is Michelle Damon Loyalka, a freelance journalist, resident of China for over 10 years. Her book is titled Eating Bitterness, Stories from the Front Lines of China's Great Urban Migration. It's published by the University of California Press. In the book, you give us about various people who live in this little city village in Xi'an.
Right.
You begin with two vegetable vendors. And again, I keep getting back to this idea of this American vision of immigration. In the case of the vegetable vendors, here they've come to the city. They're eking out a living. They're putting all their emphasis on their child, who they hope will be able to get into high school and hopefully, I guess, college. And that's the thing we should mention is that compulsory education is what, only 9 years? You
nine
have to get into high school, then get into college to sort of break through this divide.
That's right. This is a pretty critical problem, the education system in China. If you look back in the 1990s, only about 4% of people could go to college. And so China, over the last decade or so, has really spent a lot of effort in trying to expand its higher education system to make room for more people to have, you know, more access to education. And so today, about 20% of all 18-year-olds will have the opportunity, 25% of all 18-year-olds will have the opportunity to go to college. But if you look at a country like America, it's well over 50%. So obviously, a lot of the people who end up on the streets of China, sweeping the streets or selling vegetables, doing these things as migrant workers, they could have, I think, easily been college graduates in a system that, you know, had more capacity to hold people. And a lot of the migrants that we see coming to the cities now, especially, are, you know, they're dropping out in junior high school. A lot of people, a lot of kids, you know, 13, 14, 15-year-olds, come to the cities to look for more work. This is a pretty serious problem right now, and China's really trying to find a way to encourage kids to stay in school longer because, you know, right now the wages of a migrant worker are fairly close right now to, say, a recent college graduate salary. But obviously, over the course of their lifetime, college graduate salary is going to go up much higher, much faster. And also, the living conditions of a college graduate and these migrant workers is very different. So,
and I was going to just say, these vegetable vendors, you see this divide in class from a pretty early, you know, you have basically people from the high-tech zone coming in, haggling over prices with also just not a great degree of importance about the money, just haggling for, it seems like, haggling's sake a lot of times. And you see this class divide between people who think of the amount of money for the vegetables is everything and a buying population that comes from this different class where it's, you know, it's just quick, I need to get some vegetables.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, that this could really be a recipe for disaster in a place where people had a different mindset, had sort of a more, not self-centered mindset, but were really more thinking about, you know, what's fair and you know, this isn't what I want to be doing, or, you know, I want a different sort of life. But a lot of migrants, like these vegetable vendors, they grew up in much worse conditions, you know, when they were young in the countryside. You know, in that chapter, at the end of the chapter, the husband says essentially, you know, when we were young and in the villages, we couldn't even imagine owning a bicycle. And now here we are watching TV in our own room. And so we couldn't have imagined wanting anything more, basically. And we don't dare think of wanting more at this point. So it's such a divide. That's what really attracted me to this subject, is not just that there's this divide, but it is happening, you know, right next to each other, that they're working and living in these two dramatically different universes that are sort of all unfolding.
Your next story is a knife sharpener, and this is sort of talks about this change in how somebody who does something like that, the view of him has changed over the last 10 to 15, 20 years. I think it's Quan Ji?
Trenchy. Yes.
Yeah, Trenchy has no education whatsoever.
Right.
Has worked in factories at times. He's now a knife sharpener, basically going to, you know, houses, to restaurants, and basically offering to sand their cutting boards and sharpen their knives. This sort of peddler economy, which was accepted 10 or 15, 20 years ago, is now sort of it's underground. It's not quite you know, kosher, I guess is probably the best way.
Exactly. When he first started out as a migrant, say 15 years ago, most migrants were like him. They did very small-time, petty entrepreneurship from the back of bicycles. Or when he first started off, he actually carried about 30, 40 pounds of equipment on his back, just walking around from neighborhood to neighborhood. And so they didn't, people like this, when they would come to the cities, they essentially had no startup costs except, you know, buying his sandstone, essentially. But they didn't need to get permits. They didn't need to get any business licenses. They just would, you know, start walking and start doing business. But as China has developed, especially in cities like Beijing, for example, you rarely see this type of person anymore. And even in Xi'an, he had to be careful. He would often kind of go through the high-tech zone, but duck into these city villages where it was much more acceptable still to be doing some sort of, you know, peddling like that. But definitely people like him are on the way out. That's sort of a throwback to the older days. And he himself recognizes that although he's made it through starvation and collectivization and the Cultural Revolution, the Communist Revolution, China's sort of economic coming of age is the one challenge that he doesn't think that even he can survive through.
You also mentioned there's another person somewhat similar. It's part of what you call this large floating population,
right,
that will move back and forth from the villages to the cities. And this whole idea of floaters, that's a pretty derogatory term in Chinese.
That's right. Yeah, the floating population really has the connotation of people who are unstable and sort of shiftless and, you know, not necessarily dependable. And, you know, traditionally, there has been quite a sort of stereotype towards these migrants that they're not as high a quality as urban people. And I think, though, it's changing. It definitely, I see a lot more people in urban areas talking about migrants' rights, talking about, you know, that they need to have a fairer system that allows them to also be more like fully integrated into urban society. So I think that's changing to some degree, but definitely there is this term of floating population, and they're seen as outsiders in their own country. And also, I think that's interesting to note about Chinese migration is that it's typically not a one-time event. So people don't just go from the countryside into the city and it's sort of over. They come to the cities for maybe a year or two or three, but at some point they typically tend to go back to the countryside again because they have land back there, and oftentimes they've left their children back there. They have, you know, parents back there. And so then they go back to the villages for, again, a year or two or three, and then they usually will come back out to the city again. And so this sort of circular pattern of migration, many people will migrate many times over the course of their life. And so that kind of is where this idea of floating comes from.
That also explains the idea that there's 200 million people moving from the countryside to the city each year.
Right, and from year to year, it's not necessarily the same people. Yeah.
Well, you also tell us the successful immigrant story, if you will, of the migrant who's built his own little small empire, Gao Hulin?
Guo Hulin, right.
Guo Hulin.
Right.
You watch him go back to his village, but he's built his own little empire, convenience stores, restaurants, fitness centers, health clinics. He's sort of the stereotypical, I think, successful story of these migrants who, and I assume at some point he will be an urban. Is he considered an urban?
Yeah, he.
Person,
you know,
now?
He still has. I don't think he hasn't changed his registration to be an urban. You know, officially become an urban resident, but essentially for him, there's not many differences between him and someone who has an urban registration, because that, aside from going to college, that would be the other route. If you really want to become an urbanite, would be to become successful enough to, you know, be able to purchase a home in the city and sort of integrate into urban life in that way. And, you know, the thing about his story, he is sort of the stereotypical success story, but I think the thing that attracted me to his story particularly is that I think he's really representative of the direction that modern China is taking. You know, when he came to Xi'an about 5 years before I met him, he was essentially penniless. And then he did sort of, pretty quickly build up this whole empire of convenience stores. But even though now he's sort of blown past all these obstacles that are you know, typically in a migrant's path, he finds himself more kind of lonely and isolated than he ever did before. And so, you know, if you look at the way Chinese have approached development in the last 30 years, when reform started, people essentially had this mindset that you have to first develop materially before you can think of anything else. You know, so anything else besides material, making material progress, was sort of seen as a distraction. And, you know, this actually is still largely true today, but there are people like Guo Huling who have become successful enough to sort of reassess this. And you see a sort of restlessness setting in, and things that before were seen as distractions, like religion or environmentalism or social activism, volunteerism, philanthropy, all of these things are on the rise now in China. And so I don't think that most migrants are ever going to be as successful as this man became. And in fact, probably most urbanites aren't going to be as rich as this man became. But, you know, right now in China, the GDP is growing. It's doubling every 7 years. And so everyone's life is changing. Everyone's, you know, standard of living is rising, not obviously uniformly across the board, but everyone's seeing improvements. And so I think at some point, most of these migrants who have sort of just been willing to endure and eat bitterness, without questioning it, at some point they're going to also stop and sort of reassess this journey that they're on. And I think that at that point, they're not really going to be willing to just blindly sort of press ahead to the difficulties. They're going to also want more of life and, you know, frankly, more out of their labor. They want, we're seeing it already, especially with the younger migrants. They want, you know, shorter hours, better pay, more benefits, jobs closer to their families. And so, you know, this is a real challenge to the development model that China has used for the last 30 years.
And your book points out some of those seeds of discontent. You know, your subjects are still willing to eat bitterness, but you can hear in some of their stories that they're not necessarily going to wait another generation or two to see some of this divide eroded. And as you watch, you listen to China watchers, and, you know, right now in America, there's great fear of this economic prowess of China, this growing economic prowess. When we think back to how we perceived Japan in the 1980s, perhaps not the bitterness, perhaps, but still that fear exists. And a lot of China watchers say this divide between rural and urban population, as well as the increased desires of the urban population themselves, it is something that the Chinese government is going to have to be very careful in dealing with. Do you sense that?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's, I personally think it's their biggest domestic challenge for at least a decade. And I've heard a lot of different government officials in different bureaus talking about this being their key challenge, whether it's in terms of you know, education of migrants, or if it's in terms of health care, or in terms of labor laws. All of these things are serious issues. And I, honestly, if you think of just the number, 300 million people coming to the cities, you know, that's the entire population of the U.S.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so if you think of, if we tried to take every man, woman, and child in America, and within the scope of 20 years, every person is going to change their location and find a new job and find new housing, I mean, I think it would be utter chaos, really. And so when we think about it from that perspective, you can really see the enormity of the challenge that the Chinese government is facing and the potential for things to go wrong at multiple levels.
The name of the book is Eating Bitterness. Michelle Damon-Loyalka, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much. It's been great.
Michelle Damon-Loyalka speaking with us here on In Studio Tulsa. Her new book is titled Eating Bitterness, Stories from the Front Lines of China's Great Urban Migration. It's published by the University of California Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.